Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Coming up later this hour, we will invite calls from anyone who attended synagogue or church or mosque over the weekend, whether you attend service on Friday or Saturday or Sunday. We want to know what you talked about this weekend, what kinds of conversations that mattered or sermons that mattered did you hear or did you participate in, whether in a synagogue, a church, or a mosque. And we'll do that a little later this hour. So think about it, if that sounds like you, if you attended something on the religious services side this weekend and think something got talked about that mattered that you would like to bring up here. We'll do that in a little bit later this hour. And then we'll talk to Imani Perry, who's written a book on what she calls post-intentional racism. So we'll get to that. But first, Francis Fukuyama has written an extraordinary 500-page book whose title speaks for itself, The Origins of Political Order from Pre-Human Times to the French Revolution. And don't mistake the title for it not being relevant to today. It's very relevant to today. It uses the humanities, the sciences, and religion to explore where our modern societies came from. There will be a volume two, apparently, from the French Revolution to the present, but this first volume itself informs our conversations about everything from democracy in America to the current Arab Spring to the persistence of the autocracy in China and why Fukuyama thinks everything is evolving, if slowly, toward liberal democracy. Francis Fukuyama teaches at Stanford. If his name is familiar to you but you can't quite place it, he worked in the State Department for the first President Bush and is best known for his book, The End of History, The Last Man, which came out after the Cold War ended. Dr. Fukuyama, it's always fascinating to talk with you. Thanks for coming on WNYC.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
The book is so sweeping and intellectually rich, and we'll dive down into some of the specifics. But just to give the listeners an entry point, in looking at the origins of political order, was there a basic unanswered question about human society that you were trying to answer?
Well, it's funny. I'm a political scientist, and you'd think that if you were a political scientist and wanted to know basic questions like where does the rule of law come from or where does even the state come from, which we now take for granted, you can't go anywhere and look that up because there isn't a kind of basic, you know, the equivalent of economics 101 kind of textbook that tells you that sort of thing. And this was a very important question in the last few years because we've got a lot of countries that basically don't have states. We've got Haiti and Somalia, Afghanistan, other places like that. Yemen is now in the news for the same reason. And it was a big question to me, where did these powerful institutions that we take for granted in the developed world come from originally? And so that was really one of the motives that got me started on this project.
The New York Times review of your book by Nicholas Wade focused on your acceptance of evolutionary psychology, that underlying much of the origins of political order were behavioral tendencies that took shape through evolution, favoring relatives, reciprocal altruism, creating and following rules, and a propensity for warfare. Do you see those as biologically evolving starting points around which political orders emerged?
Well, I think we have a shared human nature. In a sense, you can go to literature or novels or poetry, you know, to understand the same a set of phenomena. You don't have to believe these particular evolutionary psychologists, but we obviously favor relatives over strangers, or we will do that unless we're forced to behave otherwise. We exchange favors with other people, and I think as you look at the way that politics evolves, that's the first form of sociability. Today we've evolved to these modern systems where you're supposed to hire people on the basis of their talents and technical skills and not because they're your cousin. But in a sense, we're always vulnerable to the breakdown of these modern institutions, and the moment that they break down, what reasserts itself? Well, it's human nature. It's this basic propensity to favor friends and relatives, and that's actually still the nature of politics in a lot of countries, including, I hate to say, oftentimes in American politics as well.
I'm shocked. You go back to the history of hunter-gatherers organizing then into tribes, and then later tribes organizing into nation states. And religion plays a role in the transition from hunter-gatherer humans to tribal ones. Can you talk about that?
Sure. A lot of social organization is really dependent on religion. You know, right now religion's got this bad rap because of the rise of Islamism and all of the religious conflicts we see in the Middle East and elsewhere. But I think historically religion has actually been a powerful source that binds societies together. So, for example, when you move from a simple hunter-gatherer band of 20, 30 individuals to a big tribe, they organize themselves because they all believe that they're descended from a common ancestor who may have lived three, four, five generations ago. And this allows human beings then to organize themselves on a much greater scale than in one of these very simple, very primitive societies. And it's a remarkably durable form of social organization. So in the jungle areas of India, in the deserts of Arabia, in mountainous areas like Kurdistan or Afghanistan, you have the survival of these tribal forms. And it's what we've been contending with in the Sunni triangle in Iraq and with all of the Pashtun tribes in southern Afghanistan as we speak.
Is it too big a can of worms to ask, where did the religious impulse come from?
Well, you know, that's one of those things. I don't think anyone's going to find a religion gene, but it does seem to me that every human being has a mental capacity to create a mental model of reality that is based on a belief in some kind of invisible transcendental force. Now, today, under the impact of modern natural science, we believe that there are these things like gravity and, you know, particles and so forth that explain why things happen the way they do. But traditionally, people attributed this to invisible forces like spirits or gods or otherwise, and it had this important impact of making the world orderly and giving us some handle on causality so that we could try to manipulate the world around us. And I don't know of a single human society that is not that doesn't have these shared models of reality. And so if there isn't a religion gene that we can identify, there's certainly a very common pattern of human behavior that's based on something like that.
Political historian Francis Fukuyama, author of The Origins of Political Order. We can take a few questions for him at 212-433-WNYC or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. So then continuing with your history from hunter-gatherers to tribes, and then tribalism gives way to the nation-state. And you write about China as kind of the first nation-state, the Qin Dynasty founded around 200 BC. Why China, which is so huge geographically, rather than, say, I don't know, Croatia or Panama, or take your pick of dozens of others that are much smaller modern states?
Well, I think that China is important in this story because it's not that the Chinese invented the state. You had states in Egypt and Mesopotamia and the Valley of Mexico, a lot of different places around the world. But the Chinese, in my view, were the ones that created the first modern state. Modern in the sense that it wasn't built on, you know, your friends and relatives and getting together a bunch of your tribesmen and then running a country. It was really based on very modern principles that you'd create an impersonal bureaucracy, you'd examine people for their qualifications to get into the bureaucracy, you'd organize that according to a specialized function. And the Chinese had all of this going, you know, as you said, back in the 3rd century BC. It was 1,800 years until the Europeans developed this kind of a modern state. And it's an achievement in a certain sense. I mean, that's the big Chinese historical achievement, is centralized, authoritarian, high-quality government. And I think you see that in China's current government today.
Do you see today's Middle East democracy movements through that lens at all?
Well, this is a different basket of institutions, right? The first thing that you get is the state, and that's all about power. States are really about the concentration of political power. But as time goes on, we've developed means of limiting power, and one of the most important ones is accountability, that governments shouldn't just exist for the sake of the rulers. They should respond to the needs of citizens. And I think one of the things that you're seeing in the Middle East right now is the mobilization of new groups of people that are saying, well, we don't want to live under a regime that doesn't recognize our basic dignity, that doesn't treat us like real human beings. And it's a very powerful movement that I think has been the underpinning of democracy, you know, not just this spring, but back in 1989 in Eastern Europe or in Latin America, you know, at that time, and all the way back to the, you know, the English, French, and American revolutions.
You say that Europe historically saw the first real emergence of the idea that the rule of law, the law itself, was a higher authority than the ruler. And you see feudalism, which is widely dismissed today as an abusive system. Oh, my God, the feudal system, especially where the serfs and peasants were concerned, and it was. But you see it as a step toward democracy and rule of law. Can you put feudalism in that context?
Well, this is one of those curious accidents of history. There was a feudal institution that existed in virtually all European countries. The Parliament in England, they had parliaments or sovereign courts in France, the Cortes in Spain, even Russia had an institution called the Zemsky Sobor, which were all feudal estates of notables that the king had to go to get taxes. And in a way, the reason that we have modern democracy today is that in a few countries, particularly England, these parliaments became so cohesive and powerful that they said to the king, basically, look, we're not going to give you taxes unless you give us a share of power and you agree to a constitutional settlement that says that we're the ones that are ultimately in the driver's seat. And so really the development of modern parliamentary democracy was a kind of accidental survival of this feudal institution into modern times. And the U.S. Congress is, you know, a modern version of the feudal estate that used to clip the wings of kings back in the 17th century.
Let me take a phone call for you. This is Mario in Manhattan. Mario, you're on WNYC.
Yes, I wanted to ask Professor Fukuyama how his work was influenced by the work of the American writer of ancient society, Lewis Henry Morgan, who came from New York State, upstate New York. And
who wrote what? Did he have a particular theory that was considered in advance?
Well, he's considered the father of anthropology, as Professor Fukuyama undoubtedly knows, talking about how civilization began. And his work has influenced a great number of individuals.
All right. So anything about...
No, yes, I refer to Lewis Henry Morgan in my book. He is the father of modern anthropology. He wrote a very comprehensive study of the dwindling populations of Native Americans in the late 19th century. He was actually read by Karl Marx's collaborator, Friedrich Engels, who used that then to develop this whole Marxist theory of primitive communism. It was actually a misreading of Morgan's work, but Engels said that there had been this stage where people lived together and shared property, and that actually became a misguided model for collectivism in the communist world in the 20th century. But Morgan was certainly one of the great people who elaborated the nature of tribal societies and understood that, you know, history is really this series of evolving forms of social organization.
My guest for another few minutes is Francis Fukuyama, who has now written The Origins of Political Order. And then we'll go to your calls on what were the conversations or the sermon that mattered at your mosque or synagogue or church at services over the weekend that you may have attended. You're a historian and theorist, but you've had a life in contemporary political ideas as well. You worked in the H.W. Bush State Department, consulted the World Bank on global economics. You were part of the movement to go after Saddam Hussein after September 11th, but then I believe you gave up on the neoconservative movement. Can you talk about the origin of your own political order?
Well, I guess the one of the consistent themes is that I do believe in the universality of democratic principles. My first book, The End of History and the Last Man, was really about the victory of democratic ideas. The whole George W. Bush period was, I think, a kind of painful misreading of a lot of those ideas, because I think that, you know, in my view, democracy spreads organically the way it has in the Middle East this spring. It's really not something that spreads as a result of the deliberate use of American military power, and I think that that was one of the great problems in our foreign policy over the last, you know, the previous administration, that it was, you know, I think, too militarized and too based on this idea that America specifically would serve as the motor for democratic progress. But the idea, I think, is still a valid one. And in fact, I think Condi Rice and George Bush, in a certain sense, were vindicated when they said that there's no reason why the Arabs, you know, should be a cultural exception to this universal desire to, you know, to live free of tyrannical governments.
Do you support the Libya intervention?
Well, I don't think that we had a choice when Gaddafi was about to crush the opposition in Benghazi. I think for us to have allowed that to happen would have been a terrible outcome. But I appreciate the fact that we're now stuck in a civil war that doesn't have a clear terminal point. One of the points that I argued in my book is, you know, and in fact, one of the reasons I wrote this book is that what we have failed to appreciate over the last decade is that we need institutions, that democracy isn't just the momentary enthusiasm that gets crowds out onto the street and deposes a dictator. You have to have political parties, you have to have parliaments, you have to have a free media. There's a lot of institutions that need to be in place before democracy works. And, you know, Libya, unfortunately, has been completely deinstitutionalized, and so they've got just an enormous task of political building ahead of them, and I'm afraid, you know, it's going to be a very difficult one.
Last thing. You were criticized, if somewhat misunderstood, for your book in the early 90s, The End of History and The Last Man. It was taken as that after the collapse of communism, you thought that liberal democracy was establishing itself as more or less a universal endpoint of political evolution, and that global conflicts on the scale of the Cold War would not recur. And so after 9/11, especially, there are headlines like History Resumes, which kind of tweaked you in the process. But you do seem to reaffirm here that you think there is kind of an inevitable political evolution toward what we think of as the modern liberal democratic state. Yes?
Well, I don't like the word inevitable. I don't think anyone knows the future enough to really say that. But I do think that if you take a long view of the growth of institutions, there is, you know, there is a tendency towards acceptance of democratic institutions as almost universal. Even in China, people will say they like the idea of democracy, even, you know, despite the rule of the Communist Party, and they want their government to be responsive to popular demands. And so I think that, you know, I'm not one of these Marxists that says, well, there's this mechanism of history that's inevitably going to make us all democratic, but I do think there's a universal desire, which you saw in the Arab world this spring. People want their dignity recognized by their government. They want a responsive, accountable government that can actually deliver real services to them. And that's the fundamental impulse that I think is not culturally specific, but is really driving democratic movements all over the world.
Francis Fukuyama, he has written The Origins of Political Order, From Pre-Human Times to the French Revolution. And how many years do you think it's going to take you to write part two, from then to today?
I wish I knew, and I'm sure my publisher wishes they knew also.
Well, you're pre-invited on the show when that comes out.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now, for the next 10 minutes or so, we will open the phones on what you talked about this weekend in your synagogue, church, or mosque. Of course, the WNYC community is made up of all kinds of people who attend religious services or don't. But for the next few minutes, we'll take a short survey on what the dominant topics of conversation were in your mosque on Friday, synagogue on Saturday, or church on Sunday. Call up and report in, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And all we're asking for today is just a brief mention of a conversation that mattered in your house of worship, either from the pulpit as a sermon or more informally in the halls before or after? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And given the nature of the show about politics and life, if you talked about any of the big issues of the day, the budget agreement, the Arab Spring, whatever, we definitely want to know about that. Or if they were more spiritual or theological or eternal in nature, that's okay too. But the idea is to do a quick survey of our listeners who attended religious services over the weekend and find out what topic, what sermon or conversation that mattered was on people's lips. 212-433-WNYC. For Christians, does the fact that it's just 2 weeks before Easter raise certain things that relate to contemporary issues or draw you away from that? And we won't linger too long on anyone. We'll take some deeper dives in coming weeks. But let's just do a quick survey. What sermon or conversation that mattered was on people's lips at the church or synagogue or mosque that you attended Friday, Saturday, or Sunday? Give us a call right now, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, and we'll take your calls and put you on the air right after this.